Tim Entwistle. He's taking us to glimpse a rather private garden.
I'm heading up to the studio door of Bill Henson, the celebrated artist for over 40 years, exhibiting everywhere, but most recently at the National Gallery of Victoria. But today I'm talking with Bill Henson, gardener, at his home in the inner Melbourne suburb of Northcote. Bill, your garden's been described by your friend Clive Blaze as perhaps Northern Italian style. Tell me how you'd describe what we're looking at out here.
Well, I don't consciously follow any particular style. What happens in this garden is sort of dictated by the eye and by the seasons and the time of day, and that's really what sets the tone for me.
Now, we're going to go and have a bit of a look at your library in a moment, but where we are now, this behind us is the studio. In front of us, perhaps describe what we can see. It's almost room to put a couple of cars in here.
Well, it was a car park. It was a car park. 10, 12 years ago, it was a car park, and I had the opportunity to take over this factory with its car park, and the car park very quickly turned into a garden. So the middle of the garden is basically gravel. Quarter-inch golden is what I find most, you know, sensible to walk on and rake.
Now, when you say sensible, because you like the sound?
No, it's just it's not so small that it sticks to your feet and ends up in your bed, and it's not so coarse that it makes the garden look smaller. You know, the more coarse the gravel, the smaller the space looks, and I'm quite interested in the illusions you can sort of create to, you know, size. And I like the idea that it's difficult to tell, you know, at a glance where the garden begins and ends. It's quite dense around the edges, and it has a kind of the village clearing in the middle.
It does. And there's lots of very large plants here, but yet it's only 10 years old, and some, you know, huge sort of cycads and peppercorn trees and palms and things, and some in pots as well.
Mm. Well, I, you know, the definition of a garden is a man-made environment. It's not the wilderness, and I quite like the collision of culture and nature. So pots and stone walls and all those sorts of things strike me as a sort of, you know, historically attractive and aesthetically attractive, and I've always just incorporated those things into the garden. At a practical level, also because of the canariensis palms and the overplanting, I deliberately planted very densely with these trees, larger trees. A lot of smaller plants wouldn't stand a chance in the ground because of the palm roots and so forth. So elevating them into pots and having those sit above the ground or on walls and things enables me to have an understory of things that I like which might otherwise not survive.
Now, if we look around at the plants, so you've mentioned a few of them, they're not uncommon plants in a sense. So they're things that are quite familiar and things that I remember from gardens I've lived in through the years. So you're not out for the rarest and most unusual.
No, I don't think of myself as a plantsman. If I was anything, I'd be a treesman. So for me, the large trees and the way that they delineate or at least make mysterious the topography of the environment is what I find attractive. And, you know, shrubs and smaller plants are kind of an embellishment, and, you know, that's the order of things for me.
But, and you have got embellishments, though. Like, there are giant sort of orchid masses, and there's epiphytic ferns on some of the walls, so you're not adverse to putting a few things amongst the trees.
Oh no, I mean, it's and the density is an important part of it because up here, you know, there are very few gardens and fewer and fewer. It's more and more of them are bulldozed, and so this I like the idea of a dense garden. It's mostly a green garden. Some would say, well, it's sort of more of an Italian garden than an English garden. Although if you go back further in Italian gardening history, there are plenty of flowers. Once upon a time, but it's very dense and it's green, and this produces a lovely microclimate in summer. It's always about 7 or 8 degrees cooler in here than it is out in concrete land, so that's another advantage.
Now tell me about the design, because you're, as an artist, of course, for you, you know, the look and feel and everything you do in your photographs particularly is going to be all about the detail. When you approach a garden, is it a relief and a relaxation from that concentration, or you have the same mind frame when you attack it?
Oh, well, my partner and I live and work in the same building, live upstairs and work downstairs, and you do get cabin fever sometimes, particularly when the work is, you know, refusing to atone. so you have to get out of the studio, and having a garden to walk into is a luxury and a necessity. You know, I come in here, and as with most gardening, you can go into a garden and, you know, 6 hours later you're still, you know, on your hands and knees doing something or other. You know, time just disappears. I think I would describe this as a garden for thinking in. You know, it's a space which is, in a funny kind of way, quite ambiguous. It doesn't have a pronounced sort of style. It's not an architectural statement, overly manicured thing with, you know, some, you know, overpowering symmetry and clipped box hedges. But at the same time, it's not a sort of a native garden where thing, you know, you've just got the bush basically either. So it's somewhere in between all of those things. But for me, it's just a space in which I find I drift off and I can think about things.
Do you see gardens as, well, I suppose I'm interested in your connection between a garden and nature and garden and the bigger sort of urban tree system as well?
Well, pretty much all architecture is improved by plants and gardens. And in our case, our old buildings here are completely covered in Parthenocissus tricuspidata, the Boston ivy, which loses its leaves in autumn, but shades the building. It's like a kind of air conditioning system on the outside of the building. For 1 or 2 weeks of the year, it sounds like a jet engine because there are a million bees on it. It has many wonderful advantages. And most architecture, I think, you know, seems to sort of benefit from some kind of relationship with trees and with nature in general. Most modern architecture desperately needs it. And unfortunately, we're seeing a pronounced sort of lack of, you know, foresight with that in terms of modern urban planning.
Certainly here we've got the garden sort of creeping up into the studio and certainly making a huge difference in terms of the architecture of the place as well. But let's go for a little wander up, because I saw as we came in a few books, and I suspect that's where some of your inspiration comes from. So can you take me for a wander up to your library?
Let's do that.
Gigantic trees and palms that were all dug up and put here, and that's something that's an art that perhaps had passed. You know, in the Botanic Gardens in Melbourne, I know in the early years lots of trees were moved around by Guildford, but these days we don't do it so much.
No, we'll see, in relation to that sort of loss of Melbourne's tree cover and the destruction of Melbourne's gardens, which is, you know, accelerating dreadfully, a lot of the things in my garden are sort of refugees or rescue plants. So palm trees that were going to be cut down, or the peppercorns which were being cut down for a road widening. So there are quite a few things here that have been saved from the chipper.
Great. So what was this building originally built?
It was originally Moran and Cato Stables, built in the 1880s. And after that, I think a couple of chaps came back from the Second World War and turned it into a truck depot, scrap metals, spare parts and so forth. And we've been here for about 30 years. There's a very old gardening manual, 1637 G. Cheng, I think, and it's very interesting because the poetic dimension of these things is what interests me. It's the beauty. Beauty can take many forms. It can be visual, someone can make a beautiful gesture. There are all these different ways in which beauty manifests itself, and that's probably at the centre of it. And in this old Chinese gardening manual, it talks about, it's called a practical gardening manual, and the practical advice is along these sorts of lines. When you take a piece of ground, always make the high part higher and the low part lower. And when you introduce a body of water, always make sure that it has a curve in it so that you can see the moon setting through the willow on the bank. This is practical advice, you see. And I'm interested in all of that. I think that's our idea of what's practical and not always the same as what we find in other civilizations at other times in history.
Well, look, perhaps just show me one book that's either the most practical or the least practical that you might want to impress me here, because I can see, you know, plenty of books about China, about Italy, about and old books too with photographs. Are we going to go around this way? Okay, let's pop.
A book of old photographs published in Italy years ago by Luigi Dami. And what interests me, just called the Italian Garden, but what interests me is the photographs, which would, you know, date from sort of the late 19th century through to about the turn of the century. And they show these gardens in a state This is continuity is the word I'm looking for, I think, where there's this continual subtle decay, and there's this continual sort of interplay between nature trying to reclaim sort of more formalized environments. And the photographs show you this. And what the photographs don't show you is something that's been completely tissed up and made to look brand spanking new, which is the garden tour garden we now see when we go to Italy. So the very same gardens that you see in contemporary photographs just look entirely different.
Mm. And so the pictures here, we've got, as you say, sort of decaying bits of sculpture. You've got some cypress in the background. So, you know, they're familiar, but they're not done up and tarted up.
No, that's right. And there is a kind of a fascist revisionism afoot today, I think, which I detest. And it's the idea or the arrogance that, now I'm here, we're going back to year zero. It has shades of Pol Pot about it. People want to scrape the landscape clean and start again. And I don't understand that in the way in which we treat our landscape broadly. But in terms of the way the suburbs are created, you know, they everything is removed and the ground is scraped flat and the brand new suburb, spanking brand new suburb, goes up with little regard to the kind of, you know, prior history of the landscape. And the city is the same. I mean, our cultural cringe is accelerating and deepening at such a rate of knots that we just cannot wait to pull down the very last of what little history we have. And, you know, we don't have to rely on it being bombed by an enemy. We're doing it ourselves.
Artist, photographer, gardener Bill Henson there talking to Tim Entwistle.